Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. This is your host, Dan Zupansky, for the program True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Casper, Wyoming, 1973. 11-year-old Amy Burridge rides with her 18-year-old sister Becky to the grocery store. When they finish their shopping, Becky's car gets a flat tire. Two men politely offer them a hand, but they were anything but good Samaritans. The girls would suffer unspeakable crimes at the hands of these men before being thrown from a bridge into the North Platte River. One miraculously survived. The other did not. Author and journalist Ron Francel, who lived in Casper at the time of the crime and was a friend to Amy and Becky, cannot forget Wyoming's most shocking story of abduction, rape, and murder. The two men who violated her and Amy were sentenced to life in prison, but the demons of her past kept haunting Becky until she met her fate years later at the same bridge where she had lost her sister. The book we're featuring this evening is The Darkest Night, with my special guest, journalist and author, Ron Francel. Welcome back to the program, Ron Francel, and thank you for agreeing to this interview.
Oh, Dan, you know, I always love being on your show.
Well, the feeling is mutual, Ron, and I'm sure the audience, bearing out by the amount of people that listen to the programs, you're one of the show's favorites, bar none. Now, let's start. This is a personal story for you. Obviously, we've alluded to that. Tell us a little bit about Casper, Wyoming. Set the stage for us. What was it like growing up in Casper, Wyoming for you? And in that, you can tell us what your relationship specifically was to Amy and Becky. And tell us a little bit about what Casper, Wyoming was like in 1973 when this story began.
Well, Casper was like many small high plains towns. It was sometimes barely clinging to the landscape. This windswept town, largely built on hard work in the oil fields and surrounding mines and cattle. It was just a hardworking town, and the people who lived there were hardworking people. But it was a small town, and so we enjoyed this sort of idyllic existence. Well, you know, so many of your listeners will, you know, envision those places, maybe like they've grown up, where you could ride your bike into the evening. You know, all the neighborhood kids would be out at night in the summers, and parents weren't much worried about what they were doing and what might happen to them.
Right.
It was a fairly, it felt innocent. No place is truly innocent. But for those of us who were growing up at that time there was no evil. There was no threat. There was no danger. And I think in retrospect, our parents had grown complacent about that. So this was, at least from the perspective of us kids, an innocent place. We grew up in a neighborhood that was full of kids, and we had spent a lot of years together growing up, and we had become a little more than friends and maybe a little less than brothers and sisters, but in that kind of interesting relationship between. And so next door were this family that had these girls, 11-year-old Amy, who was a tomboy and joined in all the ball games and really conducted herself in every way like one of the boys. And her older sister, Becky, who was the neighborhood beauty. And as we're growing up, we're seeing her blossom. And as we're getting to know our own maturity, I guess, we're seeing her blossom and become this young woman. So in 1973, when I'm 16, when Amy's 11 and Becky is 18, this horrible thing happens.
Right. Now tell us a little bit about Amy and Becky and their family, the Burridge family. Amy and Becky are not birth sisters, so they're stepsisters. So tell us a little bit about the family dynamic and what type of family grew up next door.
Again, a hardworking family. Their stepfather was an oil field worker. Mom, as was common at the time, a stay-at-home mom. They were in some ways a blended family. Amy and Becky were half sisters, and we didn't see that. You know, we're kids. We don't see that. We're not thinking about that, and it's in some ways. It's irrelevant because they considered themselves sisters in much the same way that all of us in that neighborhood kind of considered ourselves related in some way. So it was a family that, like many, you know, had its ups and downs, but it was, I think, a basically good family.
Right. And now these two... You say there was the stepfather worked in the oil rigs. What was there? Was there any trauma in these young girls' lives up to that point? You talk about that in 1973 in this small town, you didn't know evil from. It was just a concept in a movie to you. But what was Amy and Becky's life like? Well, you say it was typical, but was there any trauma in their life? Had they, what was their disposition, Amy and Becky? What type of personalities were they, and had they encountered any sort of trauma in their life up to that point?
Not that I know of, and nothing that in my research of the story that I could really see. I mean, their mother had been married a couple of times, and so they had that kind of unbalance, you know, working against them. But there was nothing that certainly showed itself to the rest of the world. Amy was absolutely the most vibrant little girl in you can imagine. She, in fact, we didn't even see her as a girl. She was just part of the ball team. She was absolutely the most active and vibrant, dynamic little girl that you could imagine. Becky, on the other hand, was, again, beautiful with long, dark hair and a woman, really, by the time the crime happens in 1973. But there was no, you know, in much the same way we viewed the world through our rose-colored glasses, we probably viewed each other through our rose-colored glasses. But nothing that really turned up in my later research suggested that they had a life that was, traumatic in any way.
Right. Now take us to the fateful day in 1973 where they met Ronald Leroy Kennedy and Jerry Lee Jenkins. Tell us what prompted Amy and Becky to be out at night, and tell us approximately what time did they venture off on this their journey because of their mother wanted them to do something. Tell us exactly what this chore was and what actually happened.
Take you back a little bit to that idyllic town and remember that, because it plays a role here. It's around 9 o'clock at night when mom needs something from the grocery store. There's a neighborhood market, oh, maybe a mile away. And so she asks Becky to go to the market and pick up these items for her. Becky takes her little sister, Amy, down to the store. They pull up at this little market, and it's not a big supermarket now. It's really just kind of a neighborhood market, a small store. They pull into the parking lot and get out of the car and go into the store. Unknown to them, these two criminals, Jenkins and Kennedy, were in their own car just pulling into the lot. And remember I said Becky's this beautiful young woman. They see her and immediately fixate on her. And Kennedy in particular decides he wants to meet her. Jenkins says, well, listen, just go up and talk to her. And Kennedy says, no, I've got a better idea. So while the girls are in the store, they pull up next to Becky's car. Kennedy pulls out a pocket knife and flattens one of Becky's tires. Then they retreat across the parking lot and wait. When the girls come out, they get in the car and they start to drive off, and Becky realizes she has a flat tire. She stops. And lo and behold, here these two guys drive up and say, hey, can we help you? And that's where it begins.
Now, they have a flat tire, and then these two people offer to help. What exactly did they say in terms of what was the help that they were going to offer?
They made a big show out of trying to change the tire, but the story becomes that their lug wrench doesn't work. So they say, we will give you a ride home. And Becky's a little iffy about this, but she agrees. And Amy, then, she tells Amy to go call their mom and tell the mom, don't worry, we had a flat tire, but a couple of nice fellows are going to bring us home. And she does that. She goes to a payphone and calls mom and tells her that. When she returns, Kennedy's pulls out his knife and he forces them into the car, into his and Jenkins' car, and they begin motoring around town, in a very meandering way, beating the girls and frightening them and telling them just horrific stories about what's going to happen to them and why. And it's a horror. They're terrorized through the night. And sometime after midnight, these two guys take them far, far away from the city, out into the prairie to a canyon. And over this canyon is a bridge, 12 stories above the North Platte River. A very, very narrow, almost sheer canyon. And almost as soon as they arrive, Kennedy takes little Amy out into the darkness, and when he returns, she's not with him. He's thrown her off the bridge.
What does Becky do? Does Becky believe that has happened? There is a ruse there that, you know, it's a clumsy one, but they are telling these girls something. So at that moment, what does Becky believe has happened with Amy?
They've been telling the girls that they had a friend who was killed or injured by a car that matched the girls' car's description.
Right.
And that they had to take the girls out to meet the leader of a motorcycle gang who would decide their fate. And Kennedy's story was that Amy would be the first one to go to meet the man.
Right.
And, it's kind of a haunting turn of phrase, but in fact, when he comes back to the car, without Amy, he says she ran away. So he and Jenkins then turn to the rape of Becky, and they, when they've both taken their turn with her, they take her out to the bridge, and on this very incredibly dark night, a moonless night, and they throw her off the bridge too.
Wow. Now, what happens to Becky after she is thrown off this bridge?
Imagine, if you can, a night so black that you can't see your hand in front of your face. And I know this because I spent a very dark night that matched the sky and weather conditions underneath that bridge, and it was an unnerving evening, night. Believe me, and it seemed endless. And I've covered wars, I've covered hurricanes from inside, but without a doubt, that was the most unsettling night of my life.
Interesting.
Becky caroms off the side of the canyon wall, 12 stories now. She hits about a third of the way down off a rock ledge, and then bounces into deeper water. When she hits that ledge, she breaks her pelvis in 5 places. She breaks some ribs. She has numerous other injuries. She's been beaten by these guys. She's been raped by them. She's wearing only a very thin blouse and otherwise naked on a 32-degree night, and she plunges into a river in utter darkness. She's able to dog paddle her way to the shore and drag herself across these sharp rocks out of the water. And she finds a little place down there among the brush and the rocks and the rats to hide herself, because she believes these guys are still up there. She believes they know she's lived through this horrific experience, and that they're going to try to come and get her. She's also beginning to believe that maybe this is what happened to her sister too, and her sister is down there someplace and very likely dead.
Right.
So you can imagine what's going through her mind as she hides down there in this utter blackness, hoping that they aren't going to come down after her, and freezing, because it's right at the freezing mark in temperature. The night that I spent down there was very similar. It was the same temperature, the same moonless night, and yet I was wearing a pair of jeans and a sweatshirt, and I was freezing to death.
Right.
You can imagine this half-naked woman who's been in the water and who's been raped and who's in shock because of her injuries. This just it makes me shiver just to think of it right now.
You know, you spent an incredible amount of time describing that, and it really does get an investment from the reader in her terror. And like you say, she survived this, but now she's wants to go to sleep. She wants some relief from all of this stress and pain and everything, but she says to herself, no, I can't go to sleep. She thinks that she hears these guys' voices still. And then she says, and she says to herself in your book that she just wants to wait till the dawn. And then you talk about, and this is just sort of indicative of what happens in this story anyway, a false dawn. Explain what a false dawn is. You just talked about the darkest type of night. What is this false dawn?
There is a period during every year when a very short period, as a matter of fact, when the sky conditions are such that in places away from city lights, like this canyon out in the middle of nowhere, where around 3 o'clock in the morning, the sky begins to lighten because the atmosphere is reflecting light from the Milky Way. And again, it only happens right at in this autumnal period, and it can only be seen in this kind of utter darkness. Had there been a moon that night, it wouldn't have been as accentuated as it was. But again, this is a night when there's no moon, and it is as black as you can imagine. So Becky, who has determined that when dawn comes, she will try to get out of there somehow. She doesn't know how impossible that is. She can't see anything. She didn't see anything. She's not familiar with this area. She doesn't know exactly how daunting an escape from this canyon really is going to be. But she's determined that when dawn comes, she will try to get out. Well, here she begins to see this light, and she's convinced that dawn is coming. She begins to feel that relief. But in fact, it's just this false dawn, and she's hours away from real dawn. And I found that to be heartbreaking.
Sure.
Because of all the horrors that had been visited on her, because of the betrayal of her, because of her being totally alone in this darkness, that seemed to be the ultimate last betrayal. As we learn in the book, it isn't.
Yeah,
but at that moment, I think that brief, it's not even brief, it's for a couple of hours, it looks like dawn is coming. And you can imagine the hope in her heart that ultimately is dashed.
Yeah.
Because she's literally 6 hours from dawn when she thinks it's at hand.
Right. Now, the next morning, Carl and Dorothy Strasser were going to go. They got up early and they were going to go fishing. And tell us what happened in terms of Becky and the Strassers.
Well, this elderly couple on their day off decide they're going to go out to the lake fishing. And so they get up early. They want to be at the lakeside as early as possible. And as they cross this bridge, which is really 35, 36 miles from the nearest town, they notice this strange, almost otherworldly sight at the end of the bridge. It looks like a girl, and she's wearing this bright pink blouse, but otherwise looks naked. And as they pull up, they see it is exactly that. It's Becky. Becky has dragged herself out of this canyon. Now, the photos in the book give some idea of what an accomplishment this was. It is a sheer canyon. Becky cannot walk. She can't use her legs in any way. She's broken her pelvis.
Right.
She has dragged herself up literally with her back against the canyon wall, pushing herself inch by inch with her hands and occasionally sliding back down and having to start all over again.
Wow.
But almost, it takes her about 2 hours to get, you know, up this 130, 140-foot steep wash of near the bridge and come out on the top. She is cut by the stones. She's still bloody from the experience of the night before. And this couple arrives like angels, and they find her, and they wrap her up, and they take her to the nearest settlement, the nearest gas station, and they call the sheriff. And the sheriff comes, and Becky is taken to the hospital. And it's at the hospital that she begins to describe her assailants.
Right.
Cops. This is a small town, remember?
Yeah.
They know who, exactly who she's talking about from her description.
Wow.
Jenkins is this sort of short, fat, greasy-looking guy with glasses. His good buddy and you know, partner in crime, literally, Ron Kennedy, is a tall, skinny, sort of bug-eyed, crazy-looking guy. The description probably had barely gotten out of her mouth before the cops knew exactly who she was talking about. So they went out, and they found Kennedy and Jenkins. Kennedy is arrested literally at high noon on the main street in front of the courthouse by a detective who draws his gun and pulls him out of his car, steps away from the courthouse. So there's a lot of dramatic element to this too that, again, if I made it up, you wouldn't believe it.
Right, right.
I tried to present this as a fiction. It would be difficult to believe.
Now, they first picked up Ronald Kennedy, and then they soon after picked up Jerry Jenkins. Wasn't it that Jenkins had the white Impala, the car itself? Tell us a little bit about the arrest of Jerry Jenkins and the seizing of that vehicle.
Jenkins actually is arrested while walking. They see him walking out in the sort of the down part of town, and he's arrested there and taken in. Kennedy is driving his own pickup truck, which is stopped there on the street, and he's arrested. They later, of course, get the car that was involved, and there are bits of evidence in there that come into play during the trial. Jenkins is questioned, and he gives a story that is startlingly similar to the story that Becky tells in her hospital bed. Now, we can assume they didn't collude. We can assume that they didn't come up and fabricate a story together.
Right.
So we know that the story they tell is probably pretty close to what happened, because they're both telling it.
Right.
Kennedy, on the other hand, is taken in for interrogation, and one of the detectives confronts him. Kennedy's not really sure why he's there.
Yeah.
And a detective kind of skirts around the issue and says, you know, well, this girl that... you know, where were you and Jenkins last night? And were you with a girl? Were you out at the canyon? And Kennedy's response is weird. He says, "Well, you know, you don't have any evidence." And then the cop says, "Well, I'm going to tell you, Mr. Son of a Bitch, one of them lived." And at that moment, Kennedy shuts up, and he does not talk about this case to his lawyer, to the police, to anybody, except maybe some cellmates, until I approach him 30 years later for an interview.
Right. Now, what happens in the interview with Jerry Lee Jenkins, with police interrogating him? What's the difference there?
Well, Jenkins, you have to understand these two guys. They are... very similar to the culprits in the In Cold Blood murders, Hickok and Smith. Jenkins is the follower who needs a leader.
Mm-hmm.
Kennedy is the leader who needs a follower.
Sure.
And when they spent that day before the crime drinking and doing drugs, when you introduce the chemicals with these two personalities, you get a third, completely different personality. And it's that third personality, in the body of these two guys that really commits that crime. It seems clear, looking back at these guys, that neither one of them on his own would do such a thing.
I see.
But together, and then with the alcohol, it became something else entirely. And so Jenkins, when he's arrested, sort of immediately rolls over. He immediately spills the beans. And he ultimately tells a fairly complete story about what happened. And as I said, kind of matches Becky's account on all the key elements and a few of the details. So he is probably telling the truth, of course. And what he does is he talks about, you know, Kennedy being the gas in the engine of this whole crime, and that's borne out.
Sure. Now, we talked about this right in the very beginning of this, the impact of this story, the particulars of this, because it's a small town, because of the heinous nature of this crime, it's disgusting. What are the newspaper reaction? What's the town's reaction? What is you and your chum's reaction? How does this impact this Casper, Wyoming, this small, peaceful, innocent town? What happens as a result when the reports come out?
Well, you can imagine the shock of it. One of the compelling reasons I wrote this book was because I'd never really thought about writing this story. It was after 9/11. I was coming back from the Middle East, where I'd been sent for in the first several months after 9/11 to do some reporting for the Denver Post. And it was on a return trip that I saw in a French news magazine a picture of two people who had leapt from the World Trade Centers holding hands.
Right.
And in my mind, I began to think of Becky and Amy. Now, of course, they hadn't been thrown from the bridge together, and they couldn't have been holding hands. But that image caused this weird flashback for me that without minimizing, because you can't minimize what happened on 9/11, I had already had a kind of 9/11 in my life. I had a moment when the night before, the world was one way, and the next day, it was completely different.
Right.
And that was the effect it had, not just on the kids who surrounded Amy and Becky and the people who knew them, but the town itself. The media reaction was, as you might imagine, you know, swift and shocked. The town began to talk about lynchings. This is the West, the Wild West, after all. There was a horror. There was a disgust. There was this sudden awakening to our naivete and our complacence. Not us kids, but those parents. It's also 1973, and we didn't have the same infrastructure in place, emotional infrastructure or support infrastructure that we have now. Parents believed that children were best protected from this kind of thing. There certainly weren't grief counselors visiting schools.
Right, yeah.
There certainly weren't even victim services that could help Becky deal with all the horrors that she had just endured. Children were kept away from the funerals, from Amy's funeral. It was purposely planned at a time when kids would be in school and it could kind of be whitewashed. There were no teddy bear memorials. Nobody came and and established scholarship funds. It was better if the kids didn't know. Right. And what that results in is a kind of incomplete grieving. And I found that not only in myself, but particularly in the kids who were closest to Amy and Becky. As close as I was, there were others who were closer. And I found evidence that their mourning had been so twisted and so frustrated that even as 40-year-old people, they were dealing with this in a way that was very sad and very tragic. So that was part of the effect. I like to think we've evolved since then. Maybe we've evolved too far in the other direction, but that's better than hiding it, and that's better than not dealing with it. And we certainly saw that.
Now, just for our audience to know the sort of the magnitude of this case, this trial, and its effect on this community, and in this state, there was available the death penalty, and shortly after, tell us what the prosecutor was looking for and how he was describing what they were going to do with these two men.
What's very interesting about this is that this happens in 1973. What's important about that date, in 1972, the United States Supreme Court had effectively outlawed the death penalty across the United States. They deemed that it was applied in an unconstitutional way, and everybody's death laws were thrown out. That sent all these states going back to the drawing board and trying to craft death laws that would meet the Supreme Court's strict standards. Wyoming was one of those, and Kennedy and Jenkins were the first accused killers to be tried under Wyoming's new death laws. The prosecutor, a small-town prosecutor, who really has a very, very good case, and he, in Wyoming, which has been described as a small town with exceptionally long streets, there's hardly a way to change venue, which they did, and escape the notoriety of the case. They couldn't.
Right.
They did move the case to the capital city of Cheyenne. The prosecutor put on a very good case. The defense put on a very good case at their own peril. One of the defenders was a publicly appointed and very well-liked guy who'd never handled a criminal case before. And he had to suffer through a lot of the public backlash about defending a criminal that, of course, everybody was convinced was guilty as sin.
Right.
In the end, of course, Kennedy and Jenkins are convicted and they're sentenced to die. And they go off to death row at the Wyoming prison. And their cells are literally about 6 or 7 paces from the gas chamber.
Yeah.
They wake up every morning and they see the gas chamber. They see where they're going to die.
Yeah.
They are, of course, immediately on appeal. And in 1977, the Supreme Court rules that indeed, Wyoming had failed to satisfy the Supreme Court's wishes by crafting a constitutional death law, and once again, Wyoming's death penalty was struck down, and Kennedy and Jenkins were immediately commuted to life. The problem is, in Wyoming, at the time, there was no provision for life without parole, and so on that day, literally 10 days before Gary Gilmore became the first inmate to be executed in Utah since that Supreme Court decision in 72, Kennedy and Jenkins went back to the general population at the Wyoming prison and were again, eligible for parole.
Yeah, incredible.
You can just imagine what that does to Becky, who has now endured several years here of dealing with her traumas. She's convinced that now they'll get out and they'll come back for her. And that sets her even into an even steeper tailspin.
Right. Yeah, tell us, before we get into, because we don't want to spend too much time with basically these ne'er-do-wells, it doesn't matter so much to me about the background of some of these guys, but we'll get to that because, interestingly, you have a lot of that information at the end of the book when you interview Kennedy, and Jenkins has already passed away by that time. But let's get to what happens. Like, we skipped over the trial a little bit, but it's a foregone conclusion. These guys are as guilty as sin. Of course, Becky is strong enough to testify successfully against them, and there's overwhelming information. What I thought was interesting, just to secure the trial, too, what the bit of information that really nailed them was one of Becky's contacts was found in the back seat of the car. But tell us a little bit about her testifying at trial. Like, she was not out of the woods there either, because she thought her life was in danger. And what we have is one of the strongest characters in your book too is a officer named Dave Davola. So tell us how if he's one of the people that arrest one of the killers, tell us his role right up to the very end. Tell us about Dave Davola.
Dave Davola was a homicide detective in this small town police force. At the moment this case breaks for them, of course, everybody is scrambled, and he's among several detectives who are out looking for these guys, taking a statement from Becky. He's there when Becky gives her statement. He's one of the guys who knows who these guys are. He knows them that well. He knows his town that well. He then goes out, and he's the one who arrests Kennedy there at high noon in front of the courthouse.
Right.
In this process, Davola kind of becomes a father figure, another father figure for Becky, and he becomes very protective of her. He watches over her. He's there during the trial. She's afraid of these guys, of course. She's afraid to look at them. You know, all the things that you can just imagine go through the mind of a young woman who's been raped. They intended to kill her, of course. They killed her little sister. This is a horror for her, and this is a very difficult thing. But she is the star witness. And really, there's even Kennedy and Jenkins' lawyers admit years later that they really only wanted to keep their clients from being executed.
Right.
They even tried the insanity defense, which of course requires you to say, "Yeah, I did it, but I was crazy."
Right.
So this they had very little to go on, including two clients who didn't talk to them, did marvelous work. They really did on behalf of these guys. But Becky is a real trooper, and she hangs in there. She gives amazing testimony, very difficult testimony, talking about the rape, talking about all the beatings and then what she went through that night. So, you know, the trial is kind of the pulling together of all those loose ends, but then, you know, that all happens, and the great bulk of the story is still to be told. These guys and being convicted and being sent to death row, then being taken off of death row, and then Becky's you know, personal travails that erupt from all of this. That's really the second half of the story. It's really Becky's second life.
Now, you talk about that she had some difficulties, obviously processing what had happened to her. Her sister is killed. She is traumatized, raped at a young age, at a formative age. You do put in the book too that she was a virgin before that. So this is a hell of an initiation into anything, let alone sexual relations. Now, tell us about how this strong woman, what she did to try to rebuild her life. What was some of the things that happened in her life that seemed to make her life a little bit more normal? Tell us about her life after this trial.
Well, she wants to put her life back together. She wants to be whole again. She wants to be the girl that she always thought she would be. She goes out and gets work. She works a lot of jobs. At some point, she finds that she has a talent for talking to people and selling people, and so she gets into the media scene of Casper, and she's selling advertising for a local radio station, and occasionally she'd move over to different places, but she's actually putting on a very good front. She's got this sunny sort of lively kind of personality, but behind that is something very dark, and she's hiding it from everyone else. She's getting more and more dependent on drugs and alcohol. She has never truly developed an ability to be emotionally intimate with anybody, but especially men. So there's a certain promiscuity that begins. She's having a difficult time dealing with this, and is increasingly convinced that these guys are ultimately going to get out of prison and then come after her. At one point, the citizens of Wyoming take up a petition for the parole board to just not consider paroling these guys. There were tens of thousands of signatures collected. At some point, Becky gets a copy of that, and she begins obsessively making copies of the copies of the copies and hiding them away in her apartment. She, at one point, seeks psychological help, she's at this particular moment, she's a recovering drug addict, but the doctor gives her a truth serum drug and a gas that she completely blacks out. But during this blackout period, she's got this sort of dreamy impression that this doctor is having sex with her, and she just never talks about it until she hears one of her friends in her women's group talking about how this man had taken advantage of her during a counseling session. And then somebody else pipes up, and then somebody else. And it turns out that Becky very likely had been raped a second time by a man that she had hired to help her.
Wow.
Now, again, we talk about the betrayal of this crime. We talk about the betrayal of the false dawn. We talk about a betrayal that Becky felt, that God had abandoned her and her sister. And here now she's betrayed by somebody she wanted to trust. It's all part of this downward spiral in her life.
Now, she really liked working at this small radio station, but by this time she has a daughter. Maybe you can tell us the turn of events. She has a daughter. She meets a guy named Russ, and she thinks she's actually fallen in love. She gets a chance to work at a big radio station that has a health plan, and so her daughter can be taken care of and a lot more money. But again, it seems that one glimpse of light just reveals itself to be dark again. So tell us this sort of up and down where it seems like, well, geez, that would seem to be the solution to a lot of her problems. That she'd be moving forward, but she didn't.
Well, she didn't, and she met Russ and married, and they had a daughter, but things just weren't good, and they were ultimately divorced, and she finds herself a single mother again. She finds herself as a single mother. She does get the job at the bigger radio station, and again, remember, she's trying to exude this sunny, bright, warm personality, and what that's doing is hiding the real turmoil in her. And so nobody who's likely to help her really has an inkling that they should be helping her. She again goes through some relationships. She's got an increasing dependence on the drugs and alcohol, until one night she takes her daughter out to that same bridge with her latest boyfriend, and she begins to lose it. She begins to tell the story of what had happened there about 19 years before. She's now in her late 30s. This boyfriend decides that this is a little too much for this year and a half toddler to try to absorb. And he takes her back to the car, and while he's walking her back to the car, he hears a splash, and Becky's gone. Was it a tragic accident? Did she slip and fall? Did she jump? I know what I want to believe, but who knows? There was only one person who knew what happened.
Do you think Do you think she took her own life?
I want to believe she did. I want to believe that for once, Becky decided that she was going to be in control of the next most important decision in her life.
Right.
And while I disagree to my core with the choice she made, I'm glad that she was the one making it. Because it's really too much for me to contemplate thinking that a gust of wind or a slippery place on the bridge railing or anything else, just one more tragedy, one more betrayal, was responsible for her end. I guess I just want to believe that she was the one who decided. And even if I disagree with what she decided, I want to believe that it was her choice. Am I right? I don't know.
It seemed to be a culmination of all her pain, and that's why it's sort of an unexpected, incredibly emotional conversation ensued on that bridge. And
it really seems
to be that, you know, listen, these demons are still haunting me, and this is the place where it all started, and this is the place where it's going to end. What I found was very, very tragic, and even another interesting twist is the officer Dave Davola. He made the arrest of Kennedy. He comforted the mother, Tony, Becky's mother. He was her bodyguard at trials to make her feel secure. He even stood up for her at her wedding because she saw him as a father figure. And then when she did jump off the bridge or fell off that bridge, when she went over that bridge, who did they call?
Well, and he was at that time the sheriff of this county. He had risen through the ranks and had become the sheriff, had been elected sheriff. And so everybody knew about his fondness for her. It wasn't sexual. It wasn't romantic. It was more fatherly. He was in every way her protector and her guardian, and to this day is a protector and guardian of her memory. But yeah, I mean, another, again, you know, it seems kind of hardly possible, but this is a small town, and and those relationships are many, and they're lasting.
Now, another really interesting aspect of the book, not that this wasn't enough, is that at the sentencing phase of this trial, that's when we get, you know, the pleas for these people's lives, and the real, it's really pathetic, but we get another pathetic figure doing what she can for her pathetic, you know, pathetic murderous, raping son, but the mother goes to court and tries to save the son's life, and of course, he was sentenced to death, but then it was, again, it was commuted to a life sentence. Then you get, this guy decides to pen his memoirs. So part of this memoir that he is given to you through his sister, his younger sister, is part his life. And so,
yes.
You know, he talks about, you know, he did have a horrible life. The mother attested to that. It seems reasonable that this guy didn't have some of the breaks that other people, was raised in abject poverty and neglect and abuse. But tell us about these memoirs, especially when it comes to what he had to say about the abduction and rape. What was his take on that?
Well, these memoirs are, of course, a fantasy. They're something between the Grimm's fairy tales and Penthouse Forum.
Right.
You know, it's just nonsense. It's the life that Ron Kennedy wished he could relate. The fact is, yeah, he had some things in his background that were bad, but not everybody who's beaten by his father or teased by his father or grows up in a poor part of town turns into a rapist and a killer. He's trying to justify that it's him against the world, and that's typical of the sociopath's makeup. But I included his autobiography in the book because it offered this fascinating glimpse inside the sociopathic mind that we rarely get. The actual words of these killers that we write about. And so this was, for me, a chance to give the reader a glimpse inside that twisted mind. Ron Kennedy is an unfinished soul. And my time, I spent 14 hours doing interviews with him. He exudes this sort of country boy charm that's pretty seductive, but it's just part of his sociopathic makeup.
Yeah.
He'd be angry at some of the questions that I'd ask him, usually those that were about his treatment by society or the law, and he'd choke up at others, usually about his mother. He talked about what he could see beyond the prison walls. He'd talk about his friends and family. He was very genial, and he joked freely, but he never stopped playing me. And really, this interview with him was the most important piece of this story to me. Not because he was the last survivor of the four people whose lives converged on that bridge that night, and not because he's likely to reveal anything new about the crime itself, much less accept blame, which he doesn't. And it's not because, you know, the jailhouse interview is an important part of true crime writing these days.
Right.
But because he was my mirror. You know, I wanted to know something about me. You know, I believe deeply in the value of honest journalism. I think messengers have played a role in the human community since we first started gathering in tribes. But I wanted to know if my deep-set feelings about this man, or at least what he represented, were stronger than my passion as a journalist. And I knew that if I couldn't take a step back from my feelings and allow him to tell his own story in his own voice, then I wasn't going to be the newspaper man that I thought I was. And in a sense, he would have raped me of that too. So this was a critical part of the story for me.
Right. What was interesting... interesting too, and you point this out, and just to further show the inequity of, it's not so much the system, it's just life itself is not so fair. Becky's life, it just wasn't fair. Is that this Ronald Kennedy found somebody to marry, an old childhood sweetheart. He had conjugal visits. He was a jailhouse lawyer. You did say he probably endured some, you say some sodomy or some jailhouse revenge. You know, that he got his. But in general, he lived a fairly comfortable life. Based on his background, he was comfortable with jail anyway. And he had the ability to make endless appeals. He got married. He had, I don't know if he had a child. I mean, this guy's, he's continued to live while the strong victim continued to slowly die. It's an interesting parallel in this book,
that
you point out.
He enjoyed a marvelous life as far as prison goes. I mean, if you're going to be in prison, you'd want his life. He was allowed briefly to keep a pet in his cell, a little dog. He was allowed on at least two occasions to attend family parties back in Casper, Wyoming, not far from where Becky was living at the time.
Incredible.
And with only one guard who, you know, pictures suggest this guard wasn't going to be able to do anything if Kennedy had decided to bolt. But he enjoyed some enormous privileges, including the conjugal visits for about 10 years. Every month got to sleep with his wife. So I think in the book, there's a picture even of him at a dance with his wife, a prison dance.
Yeah,
we don't normally think of dances in prison, but there he is. So, you know, it's an incredible story. If I made it up, people would shoot me down and say, impossible, these things couldn't happen. And that's the beauty of the truth. It's incredible, even though it's got to be totally credible.
Yeah, and it really is, you know, sometimes there is a little glimmer of somewhat of a happy ending. This is not a happy ending. It's just not.
It isn't in the sense that we want justice to be done and that we want the victims to come out whole again in some way. But it is in the sense that Becky gave us a roadmap to how we deal with these traumas, not just these horrific but microcosmic events in our lives and our communities, but even the big ones like 9/11, she gave us a roadmap that we need each other. We need to talk. We need to build those relationships. We need to depend on one another. And I think that in that sense, there is a silver lining, but it is a terribly, terribly dark story.
Yeah. It's very interesting story, Ron. I'm glad we had this chat this evening about it. It's just a wonderful book, and I'm sure our audience appreciated, again, you coming on and speaking about so eloquently about this very, very... We've had you on and talked about more and more as we've come on, talked about personal stories, but this one really, really will grip the reader, because it just has all those elements. Just a fascinating story. And really, Becky was a poster child or a poster woman for how you try to come back from something that most people just can't come back from at all.
Yes, you know, I was privileged to be able to keep her memory alive and to use their experience as an example for the rest of us, and that's what they gave us.
Yeah, that's very good. Well, Ron, I want to thank you very much for coming on once again.
Thank you.
And pleasuring our audience with this great description of this book. For those who have been listening to the program, we've been featuring the book The Darkest Night by journalist and author Ron Francell, Two Sisters, A Brutal Murder, and The Loss of Innocence in a Small Town, The Darkest Night. Thank you very much, Ron. Have yourself a good evening and the best of luck in the near future.
Thank you, Dan, and to you too.
Thank you very much. Good night.